loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about what's going on around the country with Medicaid, the health care insurance program for low-income people. Millions of low-income Americans, including millions of working families, are being kicked off of their health care coverage. The Republican governor of Kentucky, for instance, just announced that 500,000 Kentuckians will be kicked off of their vision and dental plans in retaliation for the Republicans having lost a court case. This is happening in places like Kentucky, Arkansas, Michigan, Maine, New Hampshire, and in many, many other states. We'll talk to expert Leo Cuello, who helps us explain why this is happening and what can be done to stop it. And then we continue our Thursday weekly series, every Thursday, called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the police, the prosecutors, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump arrived in the UK this morning for trade talks with British Prime Minister Theresa May. He dismissed large-scale protests against his visit and said, quote, "The Brits like me a lot. They agree with me on immigration," unquote. The visit comes 2 days after Trump said that the UK was, quote, "in turmoil." Next, a defiant Peter Stroke told the House Judiciary and Oversight Committees that continued scrutiny of his anti-Trump text messages amounted to, quote, "another victory notch in Vladimir Putin's belt," unquote. The FBI agent said that during the 2016 campaign, he had information that would have derailed Donald Trump's candidacy, but that he never considered releasing it. Then the annual summit of NATO heads of state ended yesterday with President Trump saying that member countries had agreed to increase their defense spending, perhaps even doubling it. But French President Emmanuel Macron was quick to say that the president's statement was untrue. Meanwhile, President Trump reiterated as he was boarding Air Force One that he is, quote, "a very stable genius." And then Israel struck three Syrian government targets overnight after an unarmed Syrian drone strayed over Israeli territory. The Syrian media reported that there was material damage, but no casualties. And finally, Monsanto is in court this week because a California landscaper has terminal cancer after using the company's Roundup weed killer for decades. And Monsanto covered up evidence that Roundup is carcinogenic. And in other headlines, in a speech at the Economic Club of Washington, D.C., Speaker of the House Paul Ryan delivered what many are interpreting as veiled criticism of the trade policies of the Trump administration. Ryan stated that the United States would fall behind other world economic powers if it did not aggressively pursue free trade agreements. Ryan is not running for re-election. According to a document obtained by AFP News, the United States has appealed to the UN Security Council to completely bar the export of refined oil products to North Korea. The United States accuses the country of evading the annual import cap of 500,000 barrels. North Korea and the United States have been engaged in high-level negotiations for several months, but recent contact between the two sides has gone poorly. Ousted Catalan leader Carles Puigdemont received a mixed verdict in a court today in Germany, where he's living in exile. The German court ruled that Puigdemont could be extradited to Spain to face charges of misuse of public funds, but not to face charges of rebellion. Puigdemont presented this decision as a victory, as the charge of rebellion is far more grave and more political in nature. This morning, Paul Manafort was transferred to the Alexandria Detention Center in Alexandria, Virginia. Manafort was previously held at the Northern Neck Regional Jail, far away from the trial venue, slowing contact with his lawyers. Manafort was briefly the chairman of Donald Trump's presidential campaign and is facing charges related to undisclosed lobbying in Ukraine. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the issue of Medicaid expansion, and the threats to Medicaid benefits for hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of Americans. In June, Arkansas became the first state to require that able-bodied Medicare recipients do some combination of work, volunteering, job training, or education just to keep their Medicaid benefits. A nearly identical law in Kentucky, however, was just struck down by a federal judge. Now states are considering simply throwing people off Medicaid rolls and denying them health care. We're joined in studio by Leo Cuello. He is an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program here in Washington, D.C. Leo, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
My opening sentence there sounded a little bit hypothetical, but it's not hypothetical. According to the governor of Kentucky, when the federal court ruled that the work requirements were illegal for people to receive Medicaid, he immediately announced that 500,000 people, at least that's what I'm reading in the mainstream media, 500,000 people were going to lose benefits for dental and vision programs.
Yeah, and transportation. That's right.
Yeah. So the Republican governor doesn't get his way. And as a retaliatory measure, 500,000 people in his state lose vital health care.
Right. And that subpoint is really interesting for a lot of reasons. I mean, I think it shows the mindset, right, which is because we as a state, because Kentucky's government requested something that's not legal, that HHS approved it in a way that was not legal, therefore we're mad and we're going to punish someone. And the people we're going to punish are these Kentuckians who are going to lose vision services and dental services, who have obviously nothing to do with what the state did, what the agency did at HHS, Health and Human Services in D.C., or what the court did, right? They're just the kind of the hostages who were taken in this. I think you also have to just make a few points. First is, it's really unclear that they have the authority to do what they are saying they're going to do in cutting these services. We've actually sent a letter to CMS and the Department of Justice asking them to clarify exactly what they're doing because it doesn't necessarily look legal. Second, they've said that they were forced to do this by the result of the court, by the court's decision, which is not only wrong, in fact, contradicts the court's decision, which was you need to preserve the status quo and not do any of the changes that you have suggested doing. And lastly, what's probably most interesting about it is the justification for doing it was, well, we couldn't get our waivers, and therefore, to save money, we're going to cut the vision and dental, which would seem to imply that the whole reason they did the waivers was to save money. And the courts have already said, you're not allowed to do waivers if your only purpose is to save money, because they're supposed to be innovative experiments. So they're kind of showing you exactly what this is about.
Leo, I understand the politics of a Republican governor wanting to do this, but I don't understand the policy of a Republican governor wanting to do this. From a policy perspective, why cut benefits like dental and optical? Why make it harder for people to get insurance? What's the upside for either a sitting governor or for the Republican Party?
Yeah, so I don't think there's an upside. I mean, I think, you know, maybe there's an optic of like looking tough among some group of people. I think it's probably a governor who doesn't want to look like he's losing, so he's trying to get out in front doing something. But let's be clear that that what's going on here is all about playing politics. If you look at the Medicaid expansion and you look at attacking the Medicaid expansion, what is it doing? If you're the governor of the state of Kentucky and you're asking yourself, what is this Medicaid expansion doing for my state? Well, first of all, the government is paying more than 90% of the cost of it, right?
The federal government, right?
So the federal government is paying 94% of the cost in this year, right? So you're only paying 6% of the bill for something that is giving you insurance for almost 500,000 people in your state, right? You'd think that's a win in and of itself. You add on to that the fact that you're talking about billions of federal dollars that flow into the state. That is a huge boost to the state economy, and this has been shown in the numbers. Boost to the state economy, boost to state businesses, increases the jobs in the state by the order of thousands. It also helps your state hospitals, which were normally taking care of these uninsured patients, right, and not getting paid, and now they're getting paid, right? And in a state like Kentucky, where you have rural areas and you have rural hospitals that run on paper-thin margins, sometimes they're running in the negative for multiple years in a row, right? These are millions of dollars that keep hospitals in the state open. So if you look at the picture, this is clearly not based on what's in the best interest of Kentuckians. It's not based on what's in the best interest of the state. It's playing politics, you know?
Yeah. You know, I really couldn't figure that out. Like I say, as Leo just pointed out as well, I understand the politics. If you want to be Joe Tough Guy cutting your budget and forcing the welfare queens and the lazy people, right, which is what so many Republican officials have called the poor over the decades. I get that. I disagree with it, but I get it. But I just don't understand from a policy perspective how it's better for a state or it's better for a country to throw people off of the health insurance rolls. That just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, except what Leo said is it's not about policy
at
all.
It's not about policy, no.
It's pure politics.
There is no policy perspective.
Matt Bevins is this governor. I mean, this is criminal conduct. I mean, you're depriving poor people of the right to fix their eyes, to be able to see properly, or to be able to go to a dentist or to have dental work done. Again, as retaliatory measure, spite, anger, I'm the tough guy, whatever it is. If the judge, Leo, said that the status quo must be upheld, is the governor in contempt?
So that's a far conclusion to get to right away.
Can I get to it as just a commentator?
I think, there's actually two issues going on. One is this cutting of these particular services. It's important to understand that in Medicaid, there are optional services, and states do have the right to add optional services and take them away. So there are legal things the governor of Kentucky can do to reduce services.
So dental and vision, dental and optical are...
sometimes can be reduced as an optional service. However, there's a question there. The other question on the table is, are they even complying with the judge's order? Because they haven't actually... it's not clear that they've provided notice to the recipients who have been previously told, you're going to have these premiums, you're going to have these work requirements, you're going to have all of these things. And it's not clear that the state has told them, oh, by the way, we're not doing those things now. So you actually have recipients paying premiums. And we really don't know right now what's going on, but we know that people don't know that they don't have to pay premiums, and they don't know that there's not a work requirement in place unless they, happen to be like watching the news and knowing about it.
So explain the premium part then.
So one of the things that the Kentucky Health Program does is it charges premiums to these low-income individuals who under the law are supposed to never have premiums because they're too poor to regularly pay premiums. So they sent notices to people saying, hey, we're going to start charging you premiums in July. They lost the case. And they haven't told people, you don't need to pay the premiums. And so apparently people are trying to pay their premiums and sending their premiums in. And it's not clear that the state is doing anything to stop that from happening. I don't know that the state is collecting money, so I'm not accusing them of that. I'm just saying that in terms of complying with the judge's order, there are even more kind of direct questions that need to be answered about how the state is going to make sure that people understand that all of these bad policies that they wanted to implement that were found illegal are not actually in effect, and people don't actually have to do those things.
So the state, I'm trying to get drilled down a little bit to understand this. So the state gets federal aid for Medicaid expansion. So 90%+ of the bill is paid for by the federal government. You said this year it would be 6% that Kentucky would pay. Then Kentucky tells low-income people, you have to go to work, you have to fill out this paperwork, you have to show us that you're good enough citizens to be able to go to a doctor, and you also have to pay a premium. You have to pay money in, which other people receiving Medicaid, because they're low income, they're too poor, don't pay a premium. So the poor people in Kentucky pay a premium. Again, they haven't been told now that they don't have to pay the premium, so they could be still spending their money. Even if Kentucky's not cashing the check, these people are giving up their money, assuming it's going to be cash, meaning that it's not part of their already limited budget.
Right. That's the situation. And now let's be as fair as we can to Kentucky and say that this was implemented.
You mean to Bevins?
Yeah, to Bevin and Kentucky. Right? This was implementing July 1st, and they got this court decision June 29th. So it stands to reason that there was no way that they were going to put a notice in the hands of all their enrollees on July 1st, right? So I don't want to make this sound like more than it is. I'm just saying that there is going to be a question because we still don't see, and I still don't see anything happening. So there, the compliance with the judge's order is going to, I think it's going to go that direction more than the direction of cutting the other benefits.
I was taking my question in a slightly different direction, even though those are really important points. And my question was this: if the federal government's paying Kentucky basically footing the bill for whatever, 90 to 94%. Kentucky's paying 6%. The state of Kentucky under the Republican leadership of Bevins is saying to poor people, hey, you got to pay a premium. They're paying the premium. Who gets the premium? Who are they paying?
So the premium is actually going into the program and reducing the cost of the program.
Reducing Kentucky's cost or reducing the overall cost?
It's kind of both, because the way it works, it's not like there are separate pots of money. It's that Kentucky spends money over a period of time and then gets reimbursed by the federal government for the portion that, so they get matching dollars.
What I was getting at is Kentucky double billing? In other words, billing the federal government and also billing poor people who shouldn't have to pay premiums.
No, I don't think that's per se the problem. But you are kind of driving at what is an important point here, and it's something that people are often really confused about when we talk about premiums for this population or copays for this population. These are not financial charges that actually generate money, right, that is meaningful. The reason they are generating money for Kentucky is that people will drop out of their health care coverage, right? Kentucky saves over $300 million in this program because 100,000 people, Kentucky would have saved, because over 100,000 people or about 100,000 people would have been terminated from their health insurance. That's how they save money. They save money when
people drop out,
people get terminated from insurance, or when people stop going to the doctor because they can't afford the copays. Right?
So, and then Kentucky makes money because they're still getting federal subsidies.
Yeah, I don't think they make money because, again, they're only getting a federal matching dollar when they spend their own dollar. So it's not like they can take federal money and not spend their own money. But they are getting much more federal money than they spend, right? For every dollar they spend, they're getting over $9 in federal matching funds.
Well, we're in the weeds a little bit, John, but I wanted to understand it because,
yeah,
again,
it's important.
And the unfortunately, the recipients who are low-income folks don't probably know all the ins and outs. I mean, about how this system works. I mean, the system was devised, Medicaid was devised to make sure that people are not completely deprived of healthcare benefits just because they happen to be poor. Anyway, we're in studio with Leo Cuello. He is an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Leo, let's talk more about this story because it's not just Kentucky, it's Arkansas, it's all over the country.
Yeah, so what I think is really important is let's take one step back before we dive into the other states and just set out our context here, which is really important. Right. If we know the Trump administration seems to be hell-bent on trying to destroy the Medicaid program, and, you know, which is a program that provides health insurance for 70 million people, mostly working families, and the adults are mostly in working families or working individuals. In 2017, their attack was through the legislature, right? They were trying to just gut the funding for the program. They failed. They just were unable to ever pass a law that they wanted to gut the program. So what did they do in 2018? They turned to trying to gut the program from the inside, right? When we've talked about it before, I've said they couldn't close the restaurant, so they were trying to poison the food. And so the Trump administration appointee runs Health and Human Services, which is in charge of Medicaid, and they're trying to gut the program from the inside by eliminating all of the protections, eliminating things that will help people get their insurance, and doing things that will terminate people. And what we have now is, in the first state where they issued such an approval, we have our lawsuit, which says, no, you cannot do this. So we have stopped them. And so for the first time, we see that in 2017, we stopped them in the legislative fight. And in 2018, the first state where they got an approval to try and do this, we have had a court shut them down. And so this is really significant because it indicates that we now have a vision for how we get to the end of this Trump administration without them destroying health insurance for 70 million people. Because if we can stop them in the legislature and through the courts, we can stop them or at least slow them down and divert them, we might actually preserve the program. So I wanted to put that out just so people get sort of the context here, which is really important. Now, in terms of states, Kentucky was the first state they approved this in, but then they approved it in many of these pieces in Indiana, Arkansas, and New Hampshire. There are several other states pending, so we are likely to see litigation in those other states as well, and hopefully we'll be stopping them there as well. We know that Arkansas is, even though Kentucky was approved before Arkansas, Arkansas is the first state that has kind of gone live. Nobody's been terminated yet, but here's what we know. We know that they sort of started the window in June. And the way it works in Arkansas, if after 3 months you're non-compliant, you get terminated from the program. So we're 1 month in, and there is a kind of group of about 8,500 people who are the first guinea pigs thrown into this. And those are the people who have gone through their first month of the 3 months that would lead to termination. Of that group of 8,500 people, only 370 are compliant right now, meaning that currently there are 8,000 out of 8,500, more than 8,000 out of 8,500 would be on pace to be terminated. Presumably, Arkansas is going to step up their game and, you know, figure out how to get some of those people covered. But that's just to give you kind of a scope. And this is a tiny little population, right? You should be able to fix this quickly. Imagine if you unleashed this on a population the size of Kentucky's Medicaid expansion group, right? And you have, and this isn't just my opinion, right? You have the Arkansas Hospital Association, right? A big industry player saying to the state, you can't do this. Some of these people can't find work because they live in a high unemployment area. Some of these people can't complete your online forms because they don't have internet access. The numbers in Kentucky, which is a kind of similarly rural state, show that 63% of the people don't have internet or broadband. And some of these people don't have transportation to get to the jobs. So this policy is, even, you know, kind of the big industry players in the state are saying to the state, this policy is really going the wrong way. And to understand what's really happening on the ground, Arkansas has basically, the government of Arkansas, which is implementing this policy, is dumping it on their insurance companies, right? They're not really paying the insurance companies any more money. They're just saying to them, these people are going to get terminated. You're going to lose your enrollees. So go figure out how to help them fill out the forms on the internet, how to help them identify how they can prove that they are working, because some of these people, right, work low-wage shift jobs where they don't even get a paycheck, so they don't have any way to prove it, right? And the point here is, I'm not talking about people who are unemployed, right? I'm talking about people who have jobs and who are going to lose their insurance because they can't fill out an online form, they can't get what they need to prove it, and the government has essentially dumped it on the insurance companies and said, hey, it's your problem, you go out and solve this. And to their credit, the insurance companies are stepping up in part because of their financial bottom line, right? Which is, they're going to lose all of these enrollees. I mean, if these 8,000 plus people don't figure out what to do, they're going to get terminated from their health insurance, and that's business that the insurance company loses.
Leo, we see this happening so far in the South, but is there more of a national movement among conservatives to do something similar? Are you seeing this happening out West in New England or in the Midwest?
Yeah, so it's happening a little bit everywhere. It's obviously not a big threat in some of our, you know, the more what you would consider traditional blue states like Connecticut or Massachusetts or Washington or California. It's a less big threat there. But you have states like Maine, states like Michigan, where this is a serious issue. So Wisconsin. So states that are either slightly blue or even kind of quite blue or purplish, where this is coming up. And what really needs to happen in those states is education for the state legislature. There's always going to be kind of a fringe group in the state legislature that's Republican that will go to bat for this policy, even when you show them, you know, very clear evidence that it's a terrible policy. But there is this other group of people who are in the middle, centrist Democrats, independents, centrist Republicans, who hear somebody say work requirement, and they sort of say, okay, we're all for work, right? And they don't understand what the policy is. And you actually have a state, Montana, that has done this, a much better way, where they're not terminating people's health insurance. They're actually trying to help connect people to jobs. And that's the big picture point here. I want my clients to be able to work. My clients want to be able to work. I want them to get the job training they need. I want them to be able to have a jobs data bank where they can call and find out about opportunities in their area. I want them to have transportation to their job. I want them to have childcare, which is a huge barrier for low-income families, have the childcare services they need to be able to go and work. So talk to me about how you're going to make that happen. Don't talk to me about, I'm just going to take your health insurance away, but I'm not actually going to do any of the things that might help you get a job. And that's the fundamental problem that people don't kind of get about that policy.
We're joined in studio by Leo Cuello. Leo is an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program here in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the efforts underway to evict people, eliminate people, millions of people, poor people, low-income people, mostly working families, from access to health care services by this coordinated assault against Medicaid in many states, including Kentucky, Arkansas, New Hampshire, Maine,
Indiana, Michigan.
Yeah,
Wisconsin.
It's not just the South. It's the South. It's the North. It's the East. It's the West. It's happening everywhere. It's cruel. It's barbaric, but it's happening. And Leo, if 8,500 of our guinea pigs, also known as Medicaid recipients, who are going to be terminated because they can't fill out the paperwork properly or meet the other requirements, of those 8,000 out of the 8,500 who are right now appear to be non-compliant, what's the main thing that, if there is a main thing, that's making them non-compliant? Is it that they can't fill out the paperwork? They don't have internet?
We don't know, is the short answer to that. Certainly, one of the reasons is many of them don't even know that there is a topic for them to be non-compliant with. They have no idea about this. Certainly, some of them don't know how to go about filling out the paperwork, going online and doing it. And of course, some of them may know but don't have internet access, right? So, and then there may be some of them who are kind of going online, but they don't have secondary things they need, like, I have a disability. That's the reason I'm not working, but I don't know how to show that I have the disability, and do I have to go back to my doctor and get paperwork, right? So there's that whole mess of what's going on. So the answer is there are all kinds of people for all kinds of reasons, and that's part of the reason why this thing is such a kind of boondoggle. It's impossible to administer.
This is, as Leo said, this is poisoning the food rather than closing the restaurant. The Republicans would like to close the Medicaid restaurant. They can't. So they're poisoning the food. And I mean, anyway, I keep using words like barbaric, cruel, criminal, because those are the only words that come to mind.
Yeah, it is really cruel. And, you know, and many of these people are just low wage earners who can't get a health insurance plan through their job because it's a low wage job that doesn't offer one. We can also, I think we should tell folks about the positive thing that's happening, which is...
Do that because we have 45 seconds.
Okay. Because we are seeing them... the leadership playing politics in so many of these states. We now have states, red states, deeply red states, Utah, Idaho, Nebraska, that are moving forward with Medicaid expansion through ballot initiatives.
That's
and it is
good.
Already on the ballot in Utah and Nebraska. Idaho is going to get it on the ballot. It already won in Maine. And that is the result of the political system failing people, not doing the right thing for the people in the state, not doing the right thing for the economy of the state.
Yeah, people have to fight back against this. Not because they're Democrats, not because they're Republicans, not because they're Greens, Libertarians,
this is
Socialists.
An issue of right and wrong.
Issue of right and wrong, and it's an issue of existence. It's an issue of life. It's an issue, you know, that's what's got to happen. We have to organize people. Anyway, that was Leo Cuello. Leo is an attorney and director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Leo, in 10 seconds, how can people learn about your group?
So they can go to our website, www.healthlaw.org. If you want to learn more about Kentucky, go to savemedicaidkentucky.org.
Excellent. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host, Brian Becker. Today, we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on the show.
There are so many interesting developments from this week that it's almost impossible to prioritize them. But I want to start with Kevin. Kevin, you forwarded to us an article entitled "Government Contractor Acknowledges Migrant Children Were Held Overnight in Vacant Office Building." And this is a CIA-linked contractor. Now, couple that with what we're hearing from Virginia, where migrant children were beaten and were starved and were denied medical care. We're talking about crimes. We're talking about crimes being committed by our government and by law enforcement against children, are we not?
Yeah. I think you have a good entryway into the story because, I guess to its credit, the Salt Lake Tribune editorial board put out this really good editorial saying that what we're reading about here, any other country, you would hear cries from around the world that these are war crimes, that are crimes against humanity being committed against people. And you might even hear calls from within the UN to haul people before an international criminal court. And I think that's important to keep at the forefront of this conversation, that what we're talking about are really awful human rights abuses that are going on against people. And so what the story is that there's a vacant office building that this contractor was using in Arizona. And in fact, if you read through this the story, one person who was brought there, one of the migrant kids, actually ran away, fled the office when they arrived. And there are several people they were trying to figure out where everyone was being put to. But I think most importantly, why we really need to talk about this is because it shows that what we're talking about when we discuss the separation of children and we talk about putting these children in different places throughout the country in different detention facilities, that there really is a benefit that the military-industrial complex can accrue from all of this, and they are definitely interested. The private contractors, the sort of defense contractors that would have benefited and been interested in security jobs, protecting officials, the different contractors that we might have heard about in Iraq or Afghanistan, these contractors stand to benefit in some way from this very heinous policy that everyone's been outraged by.
Absolutely right. And then you forwarded a second email entitled "Glades County Jail: How Public Jail Was Used to Turn Tax-Free Profit for Investors and Expand Mass Incarceration of Immigrants." I think something that most Americans don't know is that we're not just talking about these big empty federal facilities where intending immigrants and children are being held. We're talking also about local jails, city and county jails all over the country where people are being sent. Go ahead, Kevin.
Absolutely. And so the reason why this is an important story is because I think we've talked about jail towns on this podcast before, and I'm sure there's a lot that Paul could add to this potentially, but this is a county, Glades County, where the government had organized its economy around this immigrant detention, around having a jail, and it went into dire straits. It actually was going to fold and close down when President Obama's administration was in office, especially in the second term. And then Donald Trump got elected, and they've just been able to balloon the number of immigrants that they're bringing in. They're putting people in beds. They had gone down to about 68 people in 2015, and now it's just skyrocketed. And there's no, as far as I can tell, there's no current number in this article, but they've been able to shuffle a lot more people into the facility, and they're not worried about closure. And this also is great for their investors. I mean, they talk about how investors found a way that they could build this jail and make money off of mass incarceration. And so it's just a part of this policy. The policy that we're talking about with Trump isn't just about people trying to get through the border. It's also about when they get here in the U.S., how there are people who, you know, I think a lot of people who don't want immigrants to stay in the country, if that's where they stand, they think that, okay, we'll just deport, send them back to the countries where they came from. And maybe a lot of people who are viewing this policy think sensibly, if rather than dehumanizing them here, if you're not going to allow them into the country, you should just automatically deport them. But the thing is, our mass incarceration system incentivizes and says that we're not just going to send them back. We're going to keep them incarcerated in facilities here so contractors and private facilities can make money.
You're absolutely right. And it happens all across America at every level of government. Paul, I'm going to switch tacks right now, and I want to talk about a piece that you covered in Prison Legal News magazine, and it's entitled Out of Prison and Out of Work. It's a study that was just published using a national data set, and it found something that, you know, that phrase, shocking but not surprising? That's what this is. I was shocked but not surprised. So of 5 million formerly incarcerated people living in the United States, the unemployment rate is over 27%, which is higher than the unemployment rate in any period of U.S. history, including the Great Depression. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I would say that part of the thing to keep in mind, too, though, is that one of the biggest predictors of who goes to prison is people that are unemployed. So in some respects, it's like you're at high risk of going to prison if you're not employed or have low-wage employment, which I think fits in with the whole thing about prisons and jails being used to control poor people. So I think we've got that. But basically, getting out of prison doesn't necessarily change that reality. To the extent that people going into prison were unemployed or underemployed before their incarceration, it turns into a problem when they get out. And I think that a lot of this is also compounded by the fact that a lot of employers either don't want to or won't hire people that have criminal convictions, that have been in prison. And then I think that there's also, this is also compounded, I think, at other levels too, that there's also issues of racism and race discrimination, which kind of adversely affects us even further. So basically, if you're a black man who's been in prison, your chances of getting a job afterwards are, you know, basically lower than they would have been before you went to prison. So in a lot of respects, I think that this is not, like you say, it's not really surprising. And I have a lot of friends that have, I was in prison myself, I have a lot of friends that have gotten out of prison. And when I talk to people getting out of prison, that's usually one of the big things is, you know, finding a job. And that's a real, you know, that's a real issue. And then one of the issues that this also gets into is, I don't know if you've heard about the Ban the Box movement, but one of the things is a lot of employment forms have a box on there, you know, of have you ever been convicted of a felony? And if people tick off the box with a yes, all too often that ends the employment process for them. They're not getting called to an interview. They're not getting an opportunity to apply further for the job. And that's been one of the things that there's been efforts by criminal justice reform advocates, such like the Human Rights Defense Center, is getting rid of that box, or at least pushing it farther down in the interview process, so that people at least have a chance to compete for the jobs and hopefully be judged on their merits as an individual rather than based solely on, you know, their criminal history.
I had a terrible time finding a job when I got out of prison. And there were people who were offering me work, which was great. It was very helpful. They wanted to try to help me out, but every job I was offered was a minimum wage job. And so, you can't feed a family on a minimum wage job. There are lots of poor people all across the country that can tell you that. And here I am 3.5 years out of prison. And it's only now that I'm starting to get on my feet again. And I have advanced academic degrees and lots of great work experience. Most recently released prisoners do not. And so there's the potential for no end in sight relative to the job market, where they could go years, they could go for the rest of their lives and never be able to find a decent job, at least not a job where they can support their families.
Well, and I think that this is also kind of shows, I think, the government policies that exacerbate this, because at least based on kind of the anecdotal evidence that I have just from talking to a lot of people that have gotten out of prison, and not, obviously this isn't like everyone, but it seems like in a significant proportion of the cases of people that get jobs that are above and beyond minimum wage jobs, they're getting the jobs through family, you know, basically through family networks or through churches or family networks or through some mechanism outside of a formal established like job application process. And it's ironic because This is like the number one way that people getting out of prison are actually finding meaningful employment. Yet yet the government, first they cite prisons in remote rural locations far from families and those support networks and job centers. Generally the job centers that prisoners came from, that a majority of prisoners come from. And then they compound this by draconian visiting policies, restricted phone access, and, you know, cutting off the access to the very networks that help ensure prisoners are actually able to reintegrate into the community.
Right. I want to switch again, Kevin, and go to an article that you flagged for us entitled California County Puts Kids on Probation for Bad Grades, Lawsuit. You know, when I first saw it, I thought, well, it's just so blatantly unconstitutional. It can't possibly be true, but it is true. And it's happening in California today. Can you explain this?
Yeah. So as we've talked about with juveniles and the way in which the carceral system goes after them, we've talked about students who, especially students, were they brown or black skin students who get into this situation where the officers, in order to discipline them, are going beyond and arresting them or putting them into these probation programs. And so as this lawsuit is dealing with, we're talking about students who, one case here is this student, Andrew, who's 13. He kicked an orange over by an officer. The officer was standing nearby. He noticed that he didn't like what had happened, reacted by putting the student in handcuffs, then found that in his backpack, Andrew had some marijuana, received a civil infraction. Of course, this is California, so they have much more progressive laws around marijuana, so that's fortunate for Andrew. And then, gets told that he's going to be put into, that he can go into a probation program if he wants to, instead of going to juvenile court. This is just one example of what's going on. They call it this way of like dealing with pre-delinquents or delinquents people. And they're using this to deal with poor academic standards. I think like that's the thing that was most alarming to me, because I'm aware of all this stuff about school discipline and how officers abuse students. And I know that mental health issues, particularly with students who have disabilities, that officers are known to have abused them. But this thing of like, you're struggling in school and you have poor grades, and like that might have an impact and lead to officers shuffling you into a probation program. That to me is just very obscene. And yes, I just wanted to raise that on the show because it just seems like a level that shouldn't be allowed. And especially this other thing here, one last point, is that they mentioned that one of the sixth graders that is part of this lawsuit was possibly put into this probation program because a school staff complained about that student using the race card against them.
Unbelievable.
And that to me is also really just vile too.
It is vile. Paul, you've been covering these issues for a very long time. Is this something new, or is it something that we just hadn't heard of before?
Actually, this is just part of the thing that's just been kind of going on for, I mean, you've seen the steady rise of, I think, the police state infiltration of literally every aspect of our society, and the education system is basically no different. I think that, not to date ourselves, but I think probably at least me and John, at least when I was in high school in the late 70s and early 80s, we didn't have police officers assigned to our campuses. And now routinely most schools do. And there's been a lot written about the so-called school-to-prison pipeline. And basically what that is in a lot of respects is this whole thing, this criminalization of behavior basically by poor students, because I'm not aware that prep schools or schools that the rich go to, that the rich people send their children to. I haven't heard that they have police officers on staff. But what happens is I think that's one of the things is that things that 30 or 40 years ago would have been dealt with administratively, the dean or the principal or school officials would have handled as an internal matter, now it becomes police. Basically, it becomes a police matter with prosecution, and basically it's a feeder system into the entire criminal justice system. And I think that we've seen, like, you know, this is bad, but, you know, we've seen cases that are even, I mean, stomach-churning cases where you see, like, police officers tasering five-year-old children because they're having a tantrum. And kind of like, you know, when I see stuff like that, it's kind of like, okay, you know, it's a five-year-old child that weighs like 40 pounds. Does it really take three police officers to taser the child? So this whole thing about, you know, putting children on probation for bad grades, I think in a lot of respects, this is just this just signals kind of like the overall expansion of basically the police state encroachment into all aspects of people's lives, especially poor people's lives in this country.
Especially. You sent us, Paul, a couple of, I think, very important articles from Prison Legal News magazine. I want you to talk about them, and I want to get Kevin's thoughts too. But let's start with an issue that you've been covering for a very long time, and that is the cost of phone calls from prison. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so basically what's happened is there's been an overall push for, there's been market consolidation. So basically the two big players in the prison telephone market, the prison phone industry, are Securus and Global Tellink. They're both hedge fund-owned companies, and there's been some small bit players out there, CenturyLink and Telmate and a couple others. And basically they've been, Global Tellink and Securus have been steadily buying up the smaller companies, which I'd say it probably doesn't really matter that much in the bigger scheme of things, because the two big ones already had like 90% of, I guess we can call it a market, even though it's definitely not a free one. So, you know, so basically they're just further locking down their market share and becoming even more of a duopoly. And so basically what this duopoly means is that the prisons and jails are seen as the client, where basically they sell the right to exploit the prisoners and their families through monopoly contracts to these companies in exchange for kickbacks. So that's why prisoners and their families are paying, they can pay hundreds, even thousands of dollars a month in prison phone bills, and the government gets a kickback from these companies for administering those services.
Kevin, you've written about this kind of thing too. Talk about those kickbacks and how that's set up.
Well, it's terrible for prisoners, just because the actual fact that you have these kickbacks means that it's going to be harder for families to meet up and have any sort of discussion with people. You know, the sort of kickbacks actually ensure that it's harder for there to be any kind of reform. So you read about the other side of this, like, not only do we know from this discussion that you've got more consolidation of power and you've got the ability of people to benefit and make money, the other side of this is that for the prisoners, the inmates themselves, you've got impossible access to your families. You know, there's, why offer contact visits? You know, let's reduce the number of contact visits, reduce the number of time where you can visit face to face. And if you do that and you reduce the amount of time that somebody has to interact with their family, then you maybe put them in a situation where they spend more money using the service that is offered by these prison phone companies. And so then they can make more money off of people who don't have money. They're making more money off poor people, and that enriches them further.
That's exactly what happens. And it's an ongoing problem. You know, it's not that people don't know about this. It's not that Americans haven't read these articles. It's that either nobody cares or the lobby is so strong that nobody else can do anything about it. I remember when I first got to prison, I was told that calls were 25 cents a minute. Well, I didn't have 25 cents a minute. And so what people do is they tell their loved ones to get a Google Voice number in that immediate vicinity of the prison and then make a local call, which was something like 6 or 7 cents a minute. But that's the only way you can do it. And most people just don't have the wherewithal. It's very, very tough. Let's now talk about tasers. Paul, you published a piece in Prison Legal News about tasers. They're supposed to be less lethal, but they continued to kill dozens of prisoners all across the country. Tell us about tasers.
Well, basically, I'd say that they're marketed as Originally, they were marketed as non-lethal, and then as the body counts rose, they basically changed the designation to less lethal. And of course, my thing is less lethal than what? But that's basically, I think that one of the problems I have with tasers is that basically they're torture devices, and especially in a prison environment, they're really prone to abuse as torture devices. And it's funny because when you talk about, if you'd ask people, you think that it'd be appropriate to use a cattle prod on prisoners or electrocute them, generally they'd say no. But then when you ask about tasers, it's kind of like, well, you know, maybe. And I think that's one of the problems is that there's a lot of risks that are known to be associated with tasers, including the fact that they cause cardiac arrhythmia, which that's the fancy word for a heart attack, because they disrupt the electrical pulses of our cardiac system, and some people it kills them. When used, there's been everything from people literally catching on fire, their clothing catches on fire.
Sure.
From tasers. And overall, it's not so much just the thing of guards are tasering prisoners, but it also goes into they're tasering them while beating them, while pepper spraying them, and positional asphyxia often plays a role in this as well, where prisoners are handcuffed or hogtied in positions that restrict their ability to breathe, and then the taser and the pepper spray and the beatings they're being given also combine to restrict their breathing, and so, not surprisingly, death results, and it's fairly common, unfortunately. And so this has just been kind of, it's just an ongoing process of basically the more torture tools law enforcement in this country is given, unfortunately, the more often they're going to be used, the more deaths and injury is going to result. And I would say that one of the things that's interesting about Taser is that it's been marketed on the premise that somehow this results in less use of lethal force. But when you actually start getting into it, there's very few, if any, instances that I've seen where the police or prison guards will say, well, instead of using lethal force, we tasered them. Usually the people that were going to get shot anyway still got shot. The only thing is now a whole subcategory of people who would not have been shot are being tasered and tortured and in some cases killed as a result of these devices.
And that's really the danger right there, is it makes the cops feel like they can do it more often because it's not supposed to be lethal, that they can fire a taser pretty much at anybody they want in any situation that they want. In fact, it is lethal and people are still getting killed. Kevin, you've covered this issue in the past too. Give us your thoughts.
So maybe a issue that we maybe don't consider a lot, but I think is important to the conversation, is that the maker of tasers is known as Axon. And it makes most of the tasers, I believe, that police departments are using. And they're also the ones that are making the body cameras that police officers are making. And so I think when I think about, in addition to what Paul was raising, all these important issues around the brutality of tasers, there's also the fact that you could say, well, we can hold officers accountable by attaching body cameras, or we can have this very like state-of-the-art mass surveillance or facial recognition technology. But what you're doing is you're giving police this camera equipment that they can pair with the brutality of these tasers, and they can basically play out or stage the way in which they're engaging in these surprise attacks, or the way in which they're going to assault, and or if they're using these tasers for discipline, however they would defend it. They're able to put together, I believe, footage, this is how I view it, on their body cameras that they can then use to support their own narrative that they're going to provide to whether it's prosecutors or, you know, if you have any semblance of oversight in the city, you're just basically putting together this whole storyline that is going to make it impossible for families to charge or challenge the city for engaging in this sort of injustice, for allowing officers to be brutal to people within prisons.
Paul, I want to ask you about an article that you published in Criminal Legal News, the sister publication of Prison Legal News, and it's entitled "Delaware Supreme Court Describes What Constitutes Effective Counsel at Sentencing." I wonder if people realize how important this is, because there are a lot of bad attorneys in the United States. I can't tell you how many times I've heard stories of defendants' attorneys falling asleep during trial, sometimes during capital cases. One prisoner that I served with, his attorney had a diabetic, went into a diabetic coma during the trial, and the judge wouldn't replace him. You just hear these horror stories. So tell us about this Delaware Supreme Court decision.
Well, I guess basically the Supreme Court of Delaware held that this lawyer was deficient when the first time he met with his client was minutes before sentencing. So in other words, the prisoner, a guy named Darius Hardin, he pleaded guilty to physically assaulting his girlfriend, and he went to a sentencing hearing expecting to get no more than 15 years in prison, and instead he got 18 years. And he filed a motion to reduce the sentence because he argued that his lawyer was ineffective by not meeting with him before then, and he wasn't instructed on his right of allocution. And allocution is basically, that's the fancy term for a right that criminal defendants have to speak to the sentencing judge. So they can plead for mercy, they can basically tell the judge why they shouldn't get a harsh sentence or as harsh a one as the prosecution may be arguing for. And basically this is a very important right because historically this is the only time that a person accused of a crime personally has the right to speak to a judge and the court rather than through their attorney. And so in this case, the court held that that a reasonable lawyer at sentencing would have told his client about the sentencing alternatives, they'd have explained them to him, they would have informed the defendant of their right to allocution, of speaking to the court, and they'd make a strategic decision as to whether or not if the defendant exercises that right, would it help them or hurt them at the sentencing. And the judge did none of that. So basically he met with the attorney did none of that. Instead, he just met with Hardin a few minutes before sentencing. He never investigated or determined whether there was any mitigating factors to support a lower sentence, and he didn't instruct or inform or coach Hardin on how to speak on his behalf to the court and basically to give an effective allocution. So anyways, the result was that he got a higher sentence than one that the state asked for, and the Supreme Court of Delaware held that that was a result of ineffective assistance of counsel.
It's about time that there are clear guidelines. These guidelines should have come decades ago, if not longer. But anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.